We turn back to Genesis chapter 37. We're going to look at the account in Genesis 37, life of Joseph and his brothers. One of the things you find in this section of Genesis is they're long chapters, and you can't study every detail of every verse. So the aim this evening is not to comment on every single verse, but to take in the big sweep of what is happening and what's going on. What is God doing in Genesis chapter 37? There'll be there are children's sheets for the children as well. And at moments, children, I will say, children, and that's a bit of a clue, children, to listen, because that means I'm about to say something that you might need to write down for your sheets. So I'm going to give you clues and hints a couple of times tonight. Now, I still remember vividly when I was a boy. My mum had told me that there was a supermarket that was offering free behind-the-scenes tours. You could go inside, you could see the bakery and how they made bread, you could see the warehouse, and that just sounded really interesting to me. And she told me about it. A few days, maybe a week or so later, I said to my mum, "Mum, when is that tour to go around that supermarket?" And she just looked back at me, and I knew in that moment something wasn't right. And she said, "I'm so sorry, I forgot. I forgot about it." And I still like to playfully remind my mum about it, partly just because she's so unforgetful that that's the only thing I can ever think of that she's ever forgotten. The only mistake I can see in her. It sticks out so clearly in my mind for that reason. Now, I'm sure you've had people in your life who have forgotten to do something they said they were going to do for you. People who have broken their promises. People in your life who, however reliable and trustworthy and caring they are, they just forget. Or something happens that means they can't do what they said they were going to do. The story of Genesis, the book of Genesis, is about the God who always keeps his promises, the God who never forgets, the God who never finds himself in a situation where he cannot keep the promises he's made. Now, Genesis 37 verse 2 tells us that this is the history of Jacob. Or you might have, in other translations, the generations, or the seed, or the family of Jacob. Now, that word, a word very similar to that, come up 11 times in the book of Genesis. Think of it like chapters, that Genesis has 11 chapters, and each one starts with the same words. So when we read that in verse 2, this is the history of Jacob, it's telling us we're now turning over the page into a new chapter. If you want to look at other examples of that, Genesis 6 verse 9 says, these are the generations of Noah. Genesis 11 verse 27, these are the generations, this is the history of Terah, which tells about Terah's sons and daughters, and in particular, Abraham. Every time it says that, there's a new chapter in this book. Genesis is a book that shows God working through a particular family. So those chapters are where you turn over and you go down to another generation, to a new part of that same family. So it's tracing God's promises, what he's doing in that family. And then that family becomes a nation, and how God deals with that nation, how God makes promises to Abraham. I'm going to bless you and your family. They will be as numerous as the stars in the sky. Genesis is showing us how God's going to keep those promises, even in very unusual and unlikely situations. It's another promise, as well as the promises to Abraham, that God particularly has in mind through the book of Genesis. And that's the reason it talks about the seed, or the generations, or the history of Jacob, for example. So right back in Genesis chapter 3, when Adam and Eve fell, God spoke to the serpent, to Satan, and he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring, seed, family. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." And the rest of Genesis then is talking about Eve's offspring, that Eve is going to produce someone who is going to crush the serpent's head. So there's this anticipation. He's coming. He's coming. A baby's born and they think, could this be the one? Is this going to be the one to destroy Satan and win that great victory? But then he's not. So they're waiting. And they're waiting throughout the book of Genesis. So Genesis 37 onwards is the story of Jacob's children. It does focus mainly on Joseph, but this section is really all of Jacob's children. In this part of the story, you see how God is going to keep those promises to bring God's people into a promised land. But they're going to do it by this huge detour through Egypt and slavery. And we'll see as we go through these chapters, God is still working, even as Joseph and then all the people of Israel follow him and end up in Israel. As we focus in on chapter 7 this evening, I've got two headings for you. I can't claim credit for them. They're not my original headings, but someone else has got much better headings than I could come up with. So here's the first heading. Once you see the family of God, you understand the grace of God. Once you understand the family of God, you understand the grace of God. As we look at Genesis chapter 37, it introduces us to Jacob's family. But what very quickly becomes apparent is that this is not a family where everything is going smoothly, where everyone loves each other and cares for each other. It starts off in verse 2, where Joseph brings a bad report of his brothers to his father. Now, it's not unusual for children to tell tales on each other, is it? That happens all the time. There are some children who love going and telling the teacher or mum and dad who's being naughty and exactly what they've done. But Joseph, we've been told in verse 2, he's 17 years old and he's still doing it, still running to dad and say, guess what they've been doing. I find that a bit strange. I think, shouldn't he have grown out of that by 17? But maybe that sort of behaviour has been encouraged by Jacob, his father. Because in verse 3, Israel, which is another name for Jacob, Israel loved Joseph more than his other children. Jacob has a favourite son in Joseph. He gives him this tunic, this robe of many colours. So he's very out there with it. This isn't just a private favourite son. This is a coat that says, hey, everyone look here. Everyone can see this boy is my favourite. So it's not that surprising that Joseph then starts to respond by trying to dob his brothers in and tell dad what they've been up to and show how great he is in comparison. Now that's not a recipe for a peaceful family existence. I'm not excusing what his brothers do. They should have risen a brother, but it's not really a surprise when you read on and see how his brothers then respond to this. Because in verse 4, we're told they hated him. They couldn't speak peaceably to him. They couldn't be kind to him or say nice words. They hated him. But again, you can understand that. Children, you can imagine it, can't you? Children, imagine if you had a brother like Joseph. Imagine if you never got pudding because your brother always got yours. Imagine if you had to stay at home and wash the dishes and your brother got taken on trips to Disney World. Well, that's the sort of thing that's happening in Joseph and his life here. You would feel sad. And you wouldn't be very happy, and you might well start feeling jealous of your brother and wish that you could swap places. Bear in mind that this family has a history as well. Because in fact, you look at Jacob and you point the finger at him, but it actually goes back further back than Jacob. Jacob is really only carrying on the way that he's been taught in family life. Jacob had a twin, Esau. And from the moment Esau and Jacob were born, we're told back in Genesis 25, verse 28, that Isaac, their father, loved Esau, and Rebekah, their mother, loved Jacob the best. And then in that family, you read about the plotting and the rivalry between brothers and how they're constantly trying to get the upper hand on each other. So Jacob's just perpetuating what he's been taught by his family. But we're told on three occasions that Joseph's brothers hated him. We saw that one in verse 4. Then again in verse 5, Joseph tells his brothers about the dream, but they hated him even more. And in verse 8, again, they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, equally, we've got to say that Joseph doesn't cover himself in glory here either. Joseph has these dreams in verses 5 through to 11. In the first one, he and his brothers are all binding these sheaves together in the field, and all the sheaves of his brothers come and bow down to his. And in the second dream, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars all bow down to Joseph as well. Joseph's got 11 brothers, so the interpretation of the dream is pretty obvious, and his brothers can tell what it means. God is speaking here to Joseph. He is telling Joseph what's going to happen, that he's going to be a ruler, a king, that his own family is going to bow down to him. Well, that seems very unlikely. This is a 17-year-old boy, but God is speaking here. But then what Joseph does is he thinks, well, I'm going to go and tell my brothers about this. I can't wait for them to hear. So it's hardly a surprise. They're jealous. They're angry. They don't like this brother. So you do have to think to yourself, why, Joseph, did you do it? Why did you go and stir the pot and just wind your brothers up? You just couldn't keep it to yourself. See, people don't change, do they? You see, all these things going on are very similar to the sorts of things that go on in life today. But then things lurch from bad to worse in this family. This family just gets deeper and deeper in trouble. Verse 12 to 17, Jacob sends Joseph to go and find his brothers. Now, this is a long journey. They set out, it's about 50 miles. His brothers are meant to be there in Shechem. But when he arrives, the man tells him, no, no, they've gone on to Dothan, which is another 10 miles away. So we're talking approximately 60 miles in journey here. Joseph's alone. No father, no daddy to look after him, to keep him safe now. And when they see him coming, in verse 18, they conspire together to kill him. It doesn't take them long to come up with this plan. There's something pretty hideous about all these brothers agreeing together to murder their brother. But we carry on in verse 21. Reuben hears it and Reuben objects. He says, let's throw him into the pit instead. Reuben's trying to protect his brother. There's some honour in Reuben here. He says he's hoping that he can go back and rescue Joseph later. And that's what they do in verse 24. They throw him down into the pit. And then in verse 25, they sit down to eat a meal. Their brother is there, helpless in a pit. Perhaps they can hear the cries for help. There's something quite callous about it, I think. They can just sit down and eat while this lad is crying out, begging for mercy. Saw something recently about two people in the States who murdered someone. And then immediately after they murdered him, they went to a drive-thru and had a McDonald's or something. This is just horrible, isn't it? How could you? I know, how could you do it? But then how could you eat straight up? Isn't their stomach just retching? And I think there's something here. Look at where your brother is and what you've done to him. And you can just sit down to eat as if nothing has happened. No shame at all. We carry on in verse 25, and the Ishmaelites turn up with their caravan. The Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, and so on. And Judah says, verse 26, 27, well, we might as well get some money for him. He's not worth anything to us dead. Let's get a bit of money. So they sell him. He's taken down into Egypt to be a slave. They still go back to Jacob and they show him and say, look, Jacob, looks like he's dead. Looks like he's gone. And Jacob, in verse 34, rips his clothes. He mourns. I'll never get over this. I'll go down to the grave, still grieving the loss of my son. I think we're meant to read this and think, what a family. What a bunch of people they are. They're all as bad as each other in different ways. None of them come out of this looking good. It's just one awful thing after another. Do you know what we're also meant to think? We're meant to look at this and think, these are the people God has chosen. These are the 12 brothers who are going to become the 12 tribes of Israel. These are the ones who are going to channel God's blessing throughout the whole world, the ones whose God's going to use and build his kingdom forevermore. These brothers, these are the ones who are going to produce this promised seed, this child who's going to conquer the world. Really? I think it's going to take our breath away a bit. But once you understand the family of God, then you understand the grace of God. Because God builds his kingdom. Children, you ready for this? God builds his kingdom by calling and using people like Joseph and his brothers. People like Joseph and his brothers. And God calls people, and it shines through very clearly here, he doesn't call people because of the good things they've done. Because none of those brothers would qualify. Even Reuben doesn't come out of this well, just less bad than the rest of them. God chooses to redeem us, not because of our commendable actions, not because of our excellent family life, not because of the skills we can offer him. He chooses to call us because of his grace. And maybe we think, well, I'm not really like them, though. When we think that way, actually it just shows that we don't know ourselves very well. We may be better at covering things up and hiding things. I hope we are. We probably are better at that than these people. But have you never showed favouritism? You see it in the playground, don't you? Have you ever seen children doing, it dip sky blue, it will not be you? And you can tell they've worked out where it's going to end. So they start it in just the right place. We naturally want to make things end up so that the way we want them to. You ever been jealous and allowed that jealousy to affect your actions like these brothers? Have you never, like Joseph, crowed about your achievements, wanted people to know about you and the things you've done? We always do it. We want to drop things in the conversation. We want others to know about me, about us. Maybe you've never murdered someone or wanted to murder like these brothers did. But Jesus says it's more than just murder. Everyone who's spoken an angry word, who said, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. We're angry. When we insult people, Jesus says that's sin against a holy God as well. But this is the point of Genesis 37. That God saves and uses people like these brothers. These are the people he chooses. Not just to save, but to use, to bless the entire world. That's what the church is made up of. People who are sinners, crying out, clinging to the Lord Jesus to be saved. Once you understand the family of God, you understand the grace of God. But secondly, once you see the hand of God, you understand the plans of God. I'll say it again. Once you see the hand of God, you understand the plans of God. See, on one level, Genesis 37 is about this family and what God is going to do to redeem this family and use these people in spite of the complete mess that they get themselves into. But at a deeper level, this is a story all about God's big plans. Children, he has promised a saviour to come. He's promised a saviour to come from Eve's descendants. And Genesis 37 is a part of moving them towards that saviour coming. He's promised to Abraham a land for these people to settle in, to call their own. And Genesis 37 is moving us towards that too. But here's the thing, that's not immediately obvious if you just read this chapter in isolation. If you only look at this story, it's not obvious. And it probably wouldn't have been obvious to Jacob or Joseph or any of his brothers. I don't know if you noticed when we read it, but God isn't mentioned in this chapter. His name never appears. And Moses, when he's writing this story up hundreds of years later, even though Moses can see the bigger picture and he can see how it ends, Moses doesn't choose to add God's name in here and sort of say, well, of course, at this point, what God was doing was such and such. He just tells the story as it is. And I think one of the reasons for that is it helps us to see what Joseph must have been going through at this moment. Things must have started out so well for Joseph. He's enjoying life. He's his father's favourite. And then he gets these dreams. He has a bright future. Everything's looking rosy. People are going to bow down to me one day. God has spoken. But by the end of the chapter, all this seems a very long way away. He's been thrown into a pit. He ends up as a slave on this caravan being taken down to Egypt. And who knows what's going to happen to Joseph there. There's a contrast in Genesis 39 and verse 2 and verse 23. It says twice, Moses tells us, the Lord was with Joseph. This is as he's there in Potiphar's house. The Lord was with Joseph in Genesis 39, verse 2 and 23. But we're not told that in chapter 37. There's no such reassurance for Joseph in this chapter. I think we're going to see that contrast. But it's not because God wasn't with Joseph in chapter 37. There are times in the Christian life when God draws near and we're aware of his presence. We feel his comforting hand. We're aware that he's speaking to us. We read the Bible and the words just seem to come off the page and God is speaking. He's dealing with me. And there are other times when it just feels like everything's gone quiet. When we're not sure what he's calling us to do next in life. When we just don't know what God is saying. And I suspect for Joseph it's flipped from the one to the other. He starts off and God is speaking clearly. There's these dreams. And then at the end, he's going down to Egypt. So it shouldn't surprise us when that happens to us either. And actually, the 1689 Baptist Confession of Faith talks about it. I'll put it into modern English. I'll paraphrase it a little bit. It starts off by saying this. True believers may have the assurance of their salvation shaken and diminished. There may be times when our assurance that we are saved is shaken up. And it goes on to give a number of reasons why that can happen. It says it can happen, firstly, when we've neglected to preserve it. That there are times when we've done things, we've neglected our own salvation. We've ignored God and we've pushed him away, so it's not really a surprise that we're not so sure whether we're saved or not. Secondly, it says it can happen when we fall into particular sin and that sin wounds our conscience and pulls us away from God. So when we're struggling with assurance, there's a place for asking ourselves, is that happening in my life? Are there particular sins where I'm just wounding my conscience and pulling myself away from God? So it's not a surprise that I feel distant from him. But it also gives a third reason. It also says it can happen by God's withdrawing the light of his countenance and letting even those who fear him walk in darkness and to have no light. See that phrase there? Sometimes God withdraws the light of his countenance. He pulls the light away and he lets his people walk on in darkness. But then the confession says something else, which is very important. It says that even in those moments of darkness, God hasn't forgotten his people. That even when the felt presence of God is absent, he says we will be kept and preserved from utter despair. Children, God had not forgotten Joseph. God had not left him when he was in the pit or when he was a slave going to Egypt. God had not left him for a single moment. And actually for Joseph, there are a couple of glimpses of that, if he's willing to look for them, even in these verses. I'm going to give you two examples of that. Firstly, in verses 15 to 17, you've got what seems to be a pointless bit of the story. You think, why did you bother telling us that? Verse 15, 16, and so on, there's a man that finds Joseph, and there he is, wandering in the field. And the man says to him, well, what are you seeking? He says, oh, I'm looking for my brothers. And the man says, well, go up to Dothan, you'll find them there. What's the point of that bit of the story? Isn't it just a bit drawn out? There is a point to it. It's that this random, nameless man is able to direct Joseph up to Dothan and to find his brothers in such a way that the timing is that as they're there and the brothers sit down to eat, in verse 25, at that very moment the Ishmaelites turn up and they take Joseph down to Egypt, and from there the whole story of God providing for his people in Egypt, drawing them out, taking them to the promised land, the whole history of God's people and his blessing and his provision turns on a random man in the fields at Shechem. You can also see God's hand when you look for it in verse 24 as well. In verse 24, they take him, they throw him into this pit, and it almost seems incidental, but when you stop and think about it, it's not. The pit, we're told, was empty. There was no water in it. Now that's quite unusual, because this is probably a man-made well, and for a well to have no water in it, well, that's the whole point of a well. But in God's timing, and in God's planning ahead, maybe there's some sort of drought, there's no water, so Joseph doesn't drown. In the darkness, and in the fear of that pit, and in the loneliness, Joseph's being kept alive. He's being sustained. See, when we look for God's hand, even in those moments when it feels like he's withdrawn his presence and he's just pulled the curtains over us, we'll still see it. We'll still see glimpses of it, even here. Stephen, in Acts chapter 7, talks about this event in Joseph's life. It's in Acts chapter 7, verse 9. Stephen's about to be martyred, but he speaks. He does quite a long speech. He talks about a number of these Old Testament figures. In Acts 7, verse 9, he says the patriarchs, Joseph's brothers, were all jealous of Joseph, and they sold him to Egypt. But then he says this, but God was with him. God was with him as he was being sold into Egypt. Whether Joseph was receiving dreams or whether he was being thrown into a pit, whether he was ruling in Pharaoh's house or in prison, God was still with him. In the moment when Joseph would have had most reason to question, is God really there? Is he with me? I don't feel like I can see him. I can't feel his presence. Stephen's saying, oh, God was still with him. Still with him in that moment. Stephen carries on in Acts 7 and he says that God rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him wisdom and favour before Pharaoh, made him ruler over Egypt and all his household. But from the perspective of Genesis 37, that all seems so unlikely. That the fulfilment of these dreams that God has given Joseph, that seems such a long way off. He's going to have the life of a slave, surely. But here's the point. This is how God normally operates. This is God's standard way of working. That's actually Stephen's point in Acts 7, that in Joseph, what you see here is a pattern that will repeat itself again and again, not just in Bible times, in the life of Christ, but all through history, a pattern that God's chosen ones have always been rejected. I'll say that again for the children. God's chosen ones have always been rejected, but they always triumph in the end. Joseph here is rejected by his brothers. Stephen says that Moses was rejected by the people of Israel as they're wandering through the desert. All the prophets were persecuted. And then it's the same with Jesus. You can see where he's going, see where Stephen's going in his argument in Acts 7. Joseph in his life and in his experience in this chapter, we're meant to see here and learn about what Jesus is going to be like. That promised saviour who will come. That promised child of Eve. That Joseph here is a picture of Jesus Christ. How he's going to endure shame and humiliation and rejection by people who should know better. People who have got to know him well. But even one of his closest disciples will reject and betray him. But Jesus also knew, like Joseph, that he was a king. Those dreams with Joseph are showing Joseph's going to rule. He's going to be a ruler over many people. Jesus knew as well he'd be a king and people would bow down to him. And so in that moment on the cross, as unrestrained evil does its worst against him, helps us to understand Genesis 50 verse 20. In Genesis chapter 50 verse 20, later on in his life, Joseph was able to say to his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Now, as you read chapter 37, you think, how is good going to come out of this story? But in chapter 50, Joseph's saying, look, it did. And that's a picture of the cross, that you've got people doing their worst, we're meaning evil against Christ, but God meant it for good. See, once you see the hand of God, you start to understand the plans of God. That doesn't mean you can predict the future. Doesn't mean you know what's going to happen tomorrow. It doesn't mean you've got a crystal ball and God's going to tell you what's going to happen. But when you understand that God's hand really is on everything in this world, gives you great confidence that he does have a plan for it. That's what we're going to see as we study the life of Joseph, Jacob's family. It'll give us a fresh appreciation of God's grace, because it's grace to this family, people who are awful people. You see that through these chapters. It'll give us a better understanding of how God works in mysterious ways, perform his wonders. It'll give us a reassurance that whether or not we can feel his hand, his presence in our lives, he's still there. He's with his children, whether we can feel it or not. Well, we're going to sing now, and then I'm going to pray.